Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.
Off the ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
I'm prepared to anything I can.
Well, do it then.
Again.
Do it then. What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
We'll speak to the brilliant David Winner on the football show this evening. Give us a crash course in the finer details of what's been going on at Ajax this season and across the last number of years, given they're playing Manchester United in the Europa League final on Wednesday night. Before that, though, Pat Nevin. We spoke to Pat shortly before coming on air. At that stage, David Moyes had just resigned. Wanted no compensation. Just wanted to walk away, told Ellis Short in London this morning that he was done. And this was before, actually, we realised a couple of the players had refused to play at Stamford Bridge yesterday. So we don't quite get into that. But I started off by putting it to Pat that given just the mess that was the season, and specifically David Moyes' demeanour right the way through, I really wasn't surprised that he didn't have the stomach for a fight with Sunderland in the Championship next season.
I never thought he'd wall it, to be honest. I think that was a big problem. But I don't think. I know that was a big problem. Anytime I talked to him over the past season, he continued to stay in the same thing. Promises that were made at the start of the season, they weren't kept. He thought he was going to get a certain amount of money to actually rebuild just before the start of the season. And then even at the transfer window, he was expecting, and he felt promised certain things and he wasn't given those things. He's kind of said it time and again. And when you hear it one time, you think, good, OK, that's that excuse. Let's move on now. Actually, no, that's it. Full stop. You know, if you've, you know, who knows if he'd have done any better had he been given what he was expected to get. So, you know, he's out now. And the difficulty he's got now, which I'm sure is the next question, is where does he go from here? You know, he's tried abroad. You know, he's tried another Premier League side. People will begin to think he's a little bit toxic now. Personally, I still think he'll get another chance in a Championship side, but I think that's where he needs to start off now.
He just seems so beaten down, so grey almost, so damaged post-Manchester United. You can trust him, and I know he was a younger man, but you can trust him with the energetic Moyes that we saw even towards the end of his spell at Everton. And it's really sad to see the way he seems to have gone, and I presume it is down to the confidence-bashing experience that the Manchester United job and Manchester United fallout ultimately was for him.
Certainly that would have a part of it, because he's a human being, and it happens to all of us, you know, if you're bashed down by that. Personally, I think there's one thing bigger than the rest of it. As an individual, and knowing him as an individual, it's nothing more complicated than he actually feels himself as a winner. You know, and if I'm not winning, I'm a failure. You know, and if you're not doing really well week to week, you know, and I had a good start off obviously with Preston. It did well for Everton a lot of the time, you know, considering the finances there. So he considered himself an absolute winner. Now, I know he feels that way because I was brought up at Celtic Boys Club, but the same attitude as that, which is, you know, we'd go down south and play with teams and you get beat one week. And you mean 20 minutes after the game, some of the players are laughing and joking. 3 days later, I'm still gutted. I'm still fed up. I'm still sick. And it was something that was bred into us when we were at Celtic, that, you know, quite good is not good enough. And even winning, but not winning particularly well, isn't even good enough. And it kind of never goes in. It's a wee bit like the Jesuits and things like that. You know, they if they get you at that age, you're stuck, and you're stuck with that mindset. Now, he's stuck with that mindset. Problem is, his team ain't winning, and he can't make them win. So you suddenly don't say, OK, I can cope with that. It's not in your personality.
He seemed very defeatist, even publicly, even from when he took over the Sunderland job. Like, I never got the sense of him, even publicly, saying, we're going to go at this and we're going to really take this on and we're going to be ambitious here. Even if, you know, stuff behind the scenes was messy. He never gave me that sense. Every time I saw him perform publicly, he looked like a man resigned.
Difficult one, either side of it. I would suggest that's just honesty. And I don't think there's anything wrong with honesty. I think sometimes we don't get it.
Does it give a license to the players?
To some degree, it would do. It would certainly give a license to players to turn off, and especially ones that aren't the best pros. And I mean that in two ways, i.e. not the best footballers, but also not the best attitude of pros. It gives you an excuse. And many people in the past have said, you know, footballers are looking for an excuse. Don't give them one. And there is definitely something in that. But any time, I certainly talked to him over the last year or so, you know, it's interesting. I went through a lot of the data and a lot of the different teams, and I do think, I mean, I'd need to double check it again, but it's either him or one other had made more tactical style system changes than any other manager in the league, i.e. trying absolutely everything and then trying a whole bunch of different... Now, he had a lot of injuries as well. It seems like a lot of excuses, you know, and, you know, he may well not be the manager he was before, and the hunger might have been slightly beaten out of him to some degree, and only he will really know that. But I still watched a guy who was trying every single thing he possibly could do. And see, when you get to the end of it, you think, do you know what? I don't think there was a way there. And I look at that Sunderland team and I look what they went through, and I'm not convinced there was a way out there. If it had caught everyone fit for an entire season, they'd been fortunate that way. You never know, they might have scraped it. But I looked at the quality of those players there, and I thought, how many of them would I take if I was another Premier League team? You know, two, maybe three, maximum, sure. No more than that.
So, John Terry.
It was hilarious. And more funny has been the reaction afterwards. What is interesting is people who were actually there. I was actually at the game, and I actually turned away in this 26th minute. And when I looked back, I thought, I couldn't understand what was going on. And I thought, what the hell's going on? Because we were trying to figure out, would John Terry go off at half time? Would he go off halfway through the second half? Because he's not going to manage the whole game, etc. He was actually playing, by the way. He was playing really well when he nearly scored. And then he comes off at 26. And then the players do this, and you're thinking, well, that's pushing it a little bit, that. But, you know, there's nothing riding on it. And then I looked around myself and I thought, every one of these fans are buying into this massively. And there's people crying. And I'm going, you know what? They've probably toned it right only for this ground, but for nowhere else. Mm-hmm. And the reaction has been extraordinary. And considering... Chelsea must have considered... I mean, he wasn't going off in that 26 minutes if anything was riding that game. In fact, he probably wouldn't have got on.
Sure.
Because Conte's not like that. He just wouldn't have... He would not have accepted it at all. But he obviously realised he was going to get a part of the game. I think the argument that he would have made was, well, wait a minute, if you give me the last 10 or 15 minutes, then it takes away from the celebrations of the actual winning of the title. It doesn't matter. John, forget about all that. Mm. You're going to get abuse, mate. And that's just the way it is. And I think he knows that. And with that in mind, he's thought, well, I'll do what I think's right with the fans here and how they'll react right. And their reaction to those fans was quite astonishing. Mm. It was really quite emotional with a lot of them.
I can't pretend to care too much either way, to be honest. You know, I saw it and I thought, well, that's a bit...
You and me together.
Yeah, I just can't summon the energy to pretend to even have a strong argument about this. The jarring moment comes when... David Moyes admits it was all preordained and prearranged, and Sunderland were in on it.
I don't know if that's jarring. The reason why it's not jarring is, see, if you try and do it without their permission, then you're taking them for granted, and then you're showing them a lack of respect. You show them the respect to say, we're going to do this. You're right. Are you okay with that?
Mm.
Yeah, okay. And by the way, if Moyes says no, you say, fine, okay, we'll carry on.
That's fair enough. But I think when you reach that point where there has to be collusion, and even if it is for reasons of respect, then I think everybody involved should say, do you know what? Let's not do it. John Terry's not a child. He can come off in the 33rd minute. It won't detract from the situation. Like, that it had to be the 26th minute just struck me as unbelievably childish and nonsensical. Like, let's just broadly agree to take him off half an hour in, 26 minutes in, if we can. Hey, maybe the gods will intervene. But when you get to a point where there has to be collusion, that was a very jarring moment when I saw that David Moyes had confirmed it was all prearranged. And I know I'm not implying there was anything iffy about this, but even thousands of pounds have been won in bets on John Terry coming off in 26th minute, and these were just fans who honestly took a punt. You know, I wonder if they would do it. So that adds an extra layer to it. But that it was so important for John Terry, and this was all his idea, by the way, which is the other kind of silly thing, that it was so important for John Terry to come off in the 26th minute that it required collusion. That's where I think everybody here just misjudged this totally.
Yeah, and to be honest, we say misjudged it. I'm a bit of an old fuddy-duddy in those sort of things anyway. I mean, I've kind of got no time for any of it.
Yeah.
I just don't, like yourself, it has no effect on me. I don't care. I mean, there's been plenty of players that finish their career and do weird things, and you think, oh, just, you played, you've had your time finished, move on. I mean, I'll give you the perfect example myself. At the end of a 19-year career, And it was my final game for Motherwell. We were playing against Rangers, and the chairman had said, you know, I'm player plus chief executive at the time. Oh, we want him to do a big thing on the pitch afterwards. And I said, well, you can want all you like. I'm not going to be there. I'm not interested. It's final game. It's another game. Just get on with it. It's about the team. And then he did something. He didn't tell me he was doing it. He made a pull-out in the programme of history of my career, and it was all done in this glossy, sentimental way. And angry's not the right word, but I really was slightly upset by it because I didn't want any of it. I've nothing got to do with me. You've had your time. Move on. Next guy. It doesn't matter who you are. That's me. That's who I am. But maybe I'm an old fuddy-duddy. In the age of selfies, in the age of self-promotion, in the age of David Beckham seen as, you know, a hero for millions and millions because of all this self-sales, it has no effect on me. But it doesn't mean to say that it won't have effect on others. And it certainly does have a positive effect on others. So carry on. But to me, shrug your shoulders. All I would say, looking back in someone like John Terry, hey, you had a right good career, by the way. And you actually were a very good leader.
Sure.
And well, boy, you have, without even a shadow of a doubt, the most successful player, maybe even the most important player that football club's ever had. That's enough. Just saying those lines is enough.
And you'll still get to make a speech. And you'll still get to do a lap of honour. Everybody knows what's going on. And we'll still take you off at a certain point in the game.
Yeah, I don't
know. I think the old fuddy-duddy thing, like, you know, I don't even think this is a generational thing. I don't think Paul Scholes would do this in a million years. I don't think Ryan Giggs did anything like this.
I mean, you know, but
Chelsea lads, what is the deal? They're, I mean, the egos are out of control.
Yeah. Tell me some players who aren't seriously. No, as you can tell, I'm not backing that action in any way whatsoever because I can't see the need for it, the point for it. But I felt a bit of a minority because I looked around that ground and the place, you know, erupted and a lot of people were incredibly emotional at it and a lot of people were quite emotional afterwards. So, you know, whether it's a misjudgment for the rest of the planet and the rest of the football or the rest of English football, it may be so. Do they care? I guess not.
No.
Because for the people inside that stadium, it wasn't a misjudgment. It was fitting.
We'll get on to the Liverpool, Arsenal and Manchester City battle in just a moment. But end of season games, generally, like it was even notable that City put 5 on Watford, Spurs put 7 on Hull, Chelsea obviously scored 5. You don't often see a weekend where there's 5, 7 and 5. I presume when you get to a point at the last game of the season and you've nothing to play for, and you know we've seen Watford's form go off a cliff since they attained safety and West Brom the same, and even in just delving into your own career, those final few games, were you just in autopilot, desperate to get away from the place? Are you always as a player shattered come the end of a season and just checking out at the earliest available opportunity?
Well, some players are, and certainly if a team that's mid-table with nothing to play for, that's certainly be part of the case. But if you're a player playing for a team that's doing well, that's playing well, have got a lot of other good players around you, the shackles are off. You're there. If you win the game, suddenly you're playing with it. Not that they play with fear all the time, but absolutely playing off the cuff. It's amazing how good that looks. And it really does look good. Oddly, you see Manchester City doing it. It looked absolutely delightful when they were doing it. And the shackles were off. And you can do things easier when there's no fear of failure. I mean, what happens if you tie a flick or a trick or a 1-2 and it doesn't come off and you're 3-0 up? Who cares? It's the end of the season. It doesn't matter. So you try things. And in actual fact, they're all quite capable of doing these things. And the best example, again, is back to Chelsea. Have a look at them. Last 7 games, 24 goals. That's the team that were grinding out the 1-0s a wee while back, you know. And they're playing some of the most stunning football to a level that I didn't actually think they were anywhere near capable of. There was one game this season against Everton where they did. But last part of the season, they're doing it. And it's not just them. You know, when the shackles are off, when there's no stress, when there's no pressure, when you're far better than the other team, who, by the way, looks after the kind of down tools anyway, and it just makes it so easy. The part of me is not actually particularly surprised at those sort of results flying in. There's the other thing which is hard to prove, and I think it's probably really important, the amount of players that aren't available for the last game and those clubs who think, well, wait a minute, I've got to move all sorted out. If I get injured here and get a six month or a year's worth of injury, then I've stuffed the next part of my career. So there's a few moody ones thrown in at that point in time by a number of players, and before you ask, no, I never did. But yeah, that's certainly part of it as well.
And mentally, as much as you love football, did you get to a point, final game done, you're driving away from the ground that evening where you think, oh, I'm so glad to be rid of this for a couple of weeks?
Yes, every time. No, yeah. Almost, yeah. No, absolutely. You get to get away from, I never was when I was nervous, and stress will happen to everyone. It's different. Stress and nervousness are different things. There was one game, actually, that really jumps out, possibly even two. But certainly one game we played June the 10th for Scotland. And I remember thinking I'd had 2.5 weeks off and came back and my body and my mind were blown. And it was a classic comment from Alan McCoist at the time. He said he couldn't play because he was mentally bruised. And he got absolutely slaughtered for that line. And I'm thinking, yeah, but I know what it means. But you get through it. You somehow manage to get through it. But you're absolutely right. In actual fact, if people think, oh, it's easy being a footballer, but the vast majority of them aren't the ones that are scoring, you know, Harry Kane amounts of goals every year.
Yeah.
Most of them are guys that are fighting and scratching every single week to keep their place, to keep their job, to keep their team in the league, all that sort of stuff. And they've got fear of losing it all the time. So, yeah, relieve that stress for a while. Mm. Most of them loved it.
You mentioned Harry Kane there. So a brief tangent. He's the Golden Boot winner. And indulge, you know, stupid questions at the end of the season. If we were setting up Pat Nevin's football club from scratch and you can't have Messi or Ronaldo, where is Kane in the queue of strikers you would choose in a perfect world?
God, he's right up there, isn't he? Because, you know, the first season, absolutely not. It can happen first season. Then they'll learn what you're good at and then we'll see what you've got. And, of course, he's arguably been better. He's missed 11 games this season and he's still the Golden Boot. The Premier League, you know, and a team that's not, wasn't seen as the team. I mean, okay, he's got Dele Alli, he's got, for me, Eriksen, probably the most important one beside them as well. But no, take nothing away from Harry Kane. The skills that he's got, the mindset is absolutely fantastic. And I think the one that tops it all, you think, what actual football club in the world, certainly Europe, definitely the Premier League, wouldn't take him in a heartbeat now. And they all kind of would. And you're even looking at the top Spanish clubs, and okay, he might not start every single week if he was at Real or Barca, but you take him to score goals. Mm. And he's that good. I mean, you're beginning to think, right, if you keep this going, you're like a Lewandowski. And that's high praise, by the way, because he's of that classic type of centre forward. He's as good as you get for dependency and goals. So, no, Harry's been absolutely fantastic. And the other thing is, I've still not met anybody that doesn't like him. That's the other thing. You can't help. In this business, as you were talking to John Terry, there's this business, it's hard to kind of stay liked just by being yourself. And because he's so straight, so down to earth. And it's been the odd time when I've been annoyed by the odd dive. But it's just not a big part of his game. So we'll allow him that just the odd time. But hopefully he doesn't need to do that anymore. And, you know, I've got not a negative word to say about him. I think he's quality.
For 39 minutes yesterday, Arsenal were in fourth spot, and then Liverpool did the business against Middlesbrough. So they have Champions League football, and Manchester City obviously have Champions League football. What's very interesting around Arsenal now is the direction of the debate, and it's gone very much around Stan Kroenke versus Alisher Usmanov. So Kroenke, as we know, has a 67% stake and has no interest in Usmanov's £1 million bid, which came...
Billion.
£1 billion, sorry. Did I say million?
Yes, it's million.
How quaint of me. £1 billion bid to take full control. Usmanov has £11.2 billion, so maybe he's coming back with more money. There's every chance. Usmanov owns 30% of Arsenal's shares, but has no decision-making powers at the club. Like, it's gone from Wenger on to, you know, silent Stan out, and Ian Wright was sort of doing that a bit on Match of the Day. It's all very interesting the way it's going. And in the midst of it all, we have Wenger, who is very much Kroenke's man. And that seems to be, the discussion around Wenger has now become a three-way chat around Wenger, Kroenke and Usmanov this summer.
That you almost have to take Wenger out of it, because the ownership battle will probably decide eventually when he goes, because all the mood music at the moment is he's going to stay under the present ownership.
Jonathan Northcroft had that front page of the Sunday Times yesterday. He's nailed on to stay.
Yeah, so and absolutely, that's been probably a few weeks, but if Jonathan goes with it, trust it, because Jonathan always knows what he's doing. He wouldn't go that big on it unless he knew. The bigger question is, you have to get inside the minds of the two guys who are fighting over the ownership of this. That becomes the most important, and most in, not the most important, but the most interesting question, because that will decide where the club goes. Now, why is he not selling it for £1 billion? That's a big question for you. Why is someone not taking £1 billion, a massive, massive profit, and, you know, you're It's simple because he's getting as much money as he likes. He is as minted as he wants to be. And it doesn't matter who you are almost on this planet to some degree, unless you're Donald Trump. If you walk out of a football club that's one of the biggest ones in the world, you can take over Microsoft just about, and you won't be as much known, talked about, discussed. You know, you won't have that fame, even though if they're quiet and they don't say much, they're still talked about. Yeah, that's what they're actually buying. I don't think they're buying any profit going into the future. Probably not, because they need to spend a lot of money. I think they're buying that. And if you walk out, you're no longer there. You have to buy into something else. What's going to be as big as Arsenal? There's not many you can buy into. So suddenly you're yesterday's man and you could be hanging about there with your £11 billion or whatever. But you're just a guy with an island. There's plenty of them.
Yeah. You look at Kroenke's teams, Colorado Rapids and the MLS, they're bottom of the Western Conference. His NHL team are bottom of their Western Conference. The Denver Nuggets in the NBA are ninth in the Western Conference, and the LA Rams in the NFL are third in NFC West. So nobody is really putting up trees. He's not actually going after winning anything. So there is certainly an issue with what Stan Kroenke wants out of owning various franchises, and maybe it is just to be talked about. So that is certainly a point against him. But equally, to kind of turn this into a Kroenke versus Usmanov debate, overlooks the fact that Arsenal of late have spent money, but spent it rather badly. And that's the bigger issue, maybe.
No, absolutely. Well, yeah, spent it quite badly when you compare it to everyone else. I mean, absolutely. Xhaka, if you get Xhaka and you spend the money on him and then you compare it to the money spent on Kante, you think, well, wait a minute. In the end, people forget about the money as long as you're up the league, and then they remember about the amount of money spent. But yeah, you look at and spend annually. Well, Spurs are miles above you and you spend loads more than them.
Yeah.
That's it. Simple. You know, so you're actually not getting value for your money. On the other hand, do they look at it in those terms? No, they don't. They look at it in, you know, the business terms. Arsenal as a business have been a monumental success for under Wenger. Unbelievable success. Much more successful than Manchester United. You know, other clubs, much more successful than Chelsea. You know, because they can turn a profit and they don't make a huge amount of losses to the owner a lot of the time. So they could turn around and make the argument. But as you and I know, we kind of are quite interested in what might happen on the pitch as opposed to what happens in the bank balance. But not all businessmen say that. They run an organisation, a business that's working quite well. It's keeping them, you know, their profile up. And in the end, you know, if they ever do want to sell it, he's still selling it at a massive premium.
Yeah. One last point is Wenger afterwards. Just very interesting here. He talked about the season and pretty forceful, I think, when he was talking about his place at the club and his relationship with the club. And the mood, the kind of the context here, I was just looking at the stats. Games 1 to 15 of the season, Arsenal second in terms of points from those games. In their final eight games, they were first in terms of points from games. But it was that middle chunk of the season, games 16 to 30, they were eighth. And Wenger, he talks about the crowd here, gives as being one of the reasons why that was so.
We had a spell during the season where it was very difficult. My personal situation had certainly an influence at some stage on the group as well. And we played in a very hostile environment for the second part of the season, what didn't help. And overall, I believe that the players came back in a very strong togetherness in the last 2 months and responded exceptionally well. I'm very proud of them. In the last 2 months, they have shown exceptional strength.
What about you? How difficult when you were the focus of attention? Supporters saying, Wenger out, he's got to go, we've had enough of him. How do you take all that? How have you managed to process that?
I focus on my job, you know. I am professional. And I think I love this club enough to give my best every single day. And that's what I try to focus on.
Oh, and if you love the club so much, many people may be puzzled as to why it's taken so long that your future is resolved, either one way or the other.
Well, you know, I don't think that's a moment to speak about that.
But you know what I mean?
I think one thing you cannot question is my love for this club, because I said no to every single club in the world to get to the end of a project when we build the stadium and to be loyal to this club. And one thing certainly nobody can question is my love for this club.
You guys owe me.
In other words. There's two lines there. Absolute two lines there that jump out. And it's in the first sentences that he made there. Talking talking about that toxic atmosphere with the fans, that seems like aimed at them. But the toxic atmosphere, because of the failures, inverted commas, of Arsenal in the last little while, and also, quite clearly, and he admitted it, the focus on him. Now, that I think, is an enormous admission, that the focus on him and his future and what was going on had a bad and a negative effect, and possibly the killer effect. Because it's only one point. They only missed out by a point. So, you know, if he says it's had an effect, then that's a massive admission. That's something that he almost should be embarrassed about, because he should have sorted himself out. He should have made it known. Because if it had been known by then, at that point in time, it wouldn't have affected them, because they could have gone on and just played normally, whether they would have said, I'm staying, or whether they would have said, I'm going. So it had that effect in that mid-period, and I'm afraid there's no one else to blame except Arsene.
A final question then. The quality of the league this season, how does it compare with recent years, the gap with Spain? What's your overall take on this? Kind of, it's a constant issue in English football. They talk about it. We're not progressing in the Champions League the way we were. The quality of this league as opposed to the excitement levels?
Well, excitement levels are generally good, apart from the last week or two there, which kind of faded out a little bit. I mean, we compare it, if you compare it with the very top two, you know, in Spain, then you've got a question mark, you know, obviously. I mean, Barcelona and Real Madrid, we know. To some degree, Germany, top one club. But apart from that, you know, I think it's not that far off. Yeah, I think
I always think it's a rough deal, actually.
Yeah, I think it's okay. It's fine. But the thing is, they do underachieve in the Champions League, or have done for quite some time. Now, in a way, it's too long now. For two or three years where things are changing around, fair enough. And even last year, I'd almost accept it, because there were so many teams that were in a massive area of transition. But this season coming, there's no excuse. There is absolutely no excuse. You've got Pep, you've got Jurgen, you've got Jose, you've got Antonio, you've got Pochettino, you've got brilliant managers there. They've all had a period of time as well. They've all had at least a year to start getting it together. Do you know what? There's no excuse for the Premier League now. Absolutely no excuse. Someone, at least one team, should get through to the semi-finals of the Champions League. And in actual fact, you'd expect a couple to get through to the quarter-finals at least. This is the time now, absolutely time now, that, you know, any excuse was fine beforehand, because you had a particularly good Atletico Madrid side for a while. Forget all that now. Time to do the business. And oddly enough, I think they will.
Pat, pleasure. We'll talk again soon.
Look forward to it.
News Talks Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
Thanks to Air, with UEFA Champions and Europa Leagues action. Brought to you by Air Sport.
You're very welcome, Max. So Ajax finished second in the Eredivisie in the last week or so, but much like Manchester United, they're very focused on a Europa League final on Wednesday evening to discuss the evolution at Ajax over the last year or so, which has been very, very interesting. We're joined on the line by David Winner, who you'll know from books such as Brilliant Orange, Dennis Bergkamp's Stillness and Speed, and Rio Ferdinand's book as well. Good evening, David.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. I know you've written about this season at Ajax, and we'll see it in The Guardian this week in the build-up to Wednesday night's final, and it's just been really fascinating what's happened. The central figure still, in many ways, in the build-up to this cup final will be Johan Cruyff, who's gone 14 months now or so. What we have here is a thrilling young Ajax side which has emerged in the last couple of months, which adhere in many ways to the Cruyff principles, and it seemed like those principles were not dead and gone, certainly, but that the Van Gaal cabal had won.
Well, the history of Ajax, it kind of, there's, since they emerged onto the world stage as a major power in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, it's kind of swung between the followers of Michels, more or less, Rinus Michels, who was the architect of the of the first great team. And he was very much a systems kind of guy and tactics. And Louis van Gaal sort of takes after him. And then on the other side, and they originally were completely together, they did it together, they created Total Football together, Johan Cruyff, who was a much more fluid, much more interested in encouraging individual special talents to be as special and as different as possible. And so that's a kind of slightly different philosophy. In the last, I guess you'd say, 20 years, more or less, since the decline of the great 95 team that won the Champions League. That was a Louis van Gaal team, great team with Patrick Kluivert and Nedjah Davids and the De Boer brothers and so on. After that, Bosman came in. Suddenly, Ajax, compared to the big teams around Europe, were very weak. And they went to this very, very long decline. And sort of the Van Gaalian philosophy took hold in various, and you know, went up and down with various coaches came and went. But that was kind of the pattern. They played, you know, very positional, possessional game, lots of ball retention, lots of passing around at the back. And the new guy, the new manager as of last summer, Peter Boss, is absolutely a devotee and a disciple of Johan Cruyff. And they had this very moving, very extraordinary encounter. He'd loved Cruyff from afar, and he collected newspaper interviews with him and made them into a little book, but he didn't really know him. And another great influence was Pep Guardiola, who was, of course, a Cruyff disciple as well. And the last thing Johan Cruyff did before he died, when he didn't know he was very close to death, he'd had a load of treatment for his lung cancer, and he seemed to be pretty good. He said he felt 2-0 up at halftime against his disease, and he went on a trip for a couple of weeks to see his son Jordi in Israel. Jordi was the technical director of Maccabi Tel Aviv, and the manager was Peter Boss. And the last photos we have of Johan were of him talking with Jordi, his son, and this other guy who we didn't really know very well. This was Peter Boss. And it's since emerged that Boss and Johan Cruyff spent most of a week together, Cruyff talking nearly all the time, sort of downloading his entire wisdom into this younger coach who he admired. And last week, Boss said, in that 1 week, I gained enough information from Cruyff to last me 10 years. And he's built this new Ajax team, very young team, almost entirely along. I mean, there are a few ideas of his own and some stuff about pressing, for example, from Guardiola. But it's hugely influenced by Cruyff. And it's suddenly brilliant. And it's, you know, people in Amsterdam can't quite believe what they're seeing, that they've got this total football, this very aggressive, high-pressing, playing as much as possible in the opponent's half. This kind of this style of football they haven't seen really for 40 years.
This meeting between Boss, the current manager, and Cruyff shortly before Cruyff's death is just an extraordinary thing to picture and imagine. We'll press pause on that for 1 second. In the more short-term context, the more recent history of Ajax, and it's something Dennis Bergkamp talked about in his book with you, back in 2011, Cruyff, frustrated by where Ajax was going, tried to lead the coup and force out old management. And that revolution was successful in part, but then it kind of broke down to an extent and people turned on each other, and the Cruyff supporters battled with those of Van Gaal, and ultimately it seems the Van Gaal supporters won. You make the point in this piece...
No, the other way around.
The Van Gaal supporters won.
No. The Cruyff supporters beat the Van Gaal supporters, but then the Cruyff guys turned on each other a bit.
Okay.
Well, it wasn't all out. Well, it was very bitter. It was very... it was an ugly and upsetting episode for everybody involved.
Yeah.
Bit like the Russian and French revolutions. You know, you have the revolution and then the revolutionaries turn on each other, and it gets all a bit fratricidal. Nobody died in that process, but there were lawyers got involved, friendships broken, all this kind of thing. And intriguingly, when Cruyff died last year, the outpouring of emotion in Holland was tremendous, but they didn't really want to talk about that episode. They regarded that as a stain on his career. They were much more interested in talking about him as a player. It was all good. But in retrospect, it seems that was a kind of precursor to what's happening now.
Although, can I jump in and put it to you then? The net result, though, of that ultimately botched coup attempt in 2011, and you mention it in your piece as well, which will be on The Guardian in the build to the game, is Frank de Boer became manager.
Well, no, he was already manager.
Already manager. Okay.
Yeah, and he stayed on, and everybody on. he was liked very much by and liked and respected by both sides.
Okay.
And he'd been initially at the very beginning of his career, him and his brother had been sort of talent spotted by Cruyff, but they'd really developed later under Van Gaal, and they were more Van Gaal guys.
Yes, and then the net result is that we saw Van Gaal football at Ajax, and you make the point, and I think Manchester United fans will be able to imagine this. It was successful, and there were four titles in a row.
I don't know why you're saying that.
Yeah. But you said the team sometimes took 20 minutes to manage a shot on goal.
Sometimes.
And this was the more recent context of Ajax on the pitch since 2011, before Peter Bosz comes along. That's what had been happening at the club.
Yes. This very slow, well, not always slow, but, you know, there's, as you say, Man U fans will be all too familiar with this. And Arsenal fans in a slightly different way, because Wenger was a big follower of Dutch football as well, and they could, in their worst moments, do the same thing, sort of noodling around at the back and not making much progress and all being rather slow and quite technical, but rather predictable. And then in opposition to that, this kind of whirlwind, very sort of daring, risk-taking kind of football, which goes back to the 70s. You know, the contrast is colossal, and the reaction of the fans has been, you know, very enthusiastic. They're excited in a way that they weren't before. So it has to be said that they haven't played any really, really top team. I mean, Schalke and Lyon, very good teams, but they're not. It's not Champions League; it's Europa League.
Mm.
So this all is quite fragile still.
Yeah.
The team could easily break up. Next, you know, the Kasper Dolberg, the striker, is coveted everywhere now. He's had a breakthrough season. Hakim Ziyech, the midfielder, he'll be in demand. Davinson Sanchez, this extraordinary Colombian defender, who came in beginning of this season, and he's playing, even though he's only 20, he's playing like, you know, the veteran Frank Rijkaard or Ruud Krol or somebody, one of these great defenders from the past. And Barcelona wanted him for their B team, and he said, no, I don't want to go there and play in the reserves. So that's why he came to Ajax instead. These guys, you know, a lot of clubs are going to want to sign them. So Ajax will have, you know, trouble keeping this team together.
Yeah. Bosz was in Israel when Cruyff went to visit Jordi, his son, back in March 2016, because he was the manager there at Maccabi. Do we have any sense that Cruyff Senior and Junior recognised that somebody like Bosz could go on and re-establish the Cruyffian values at Ajax, or was it just that this was almost a paternal senior football man giving an up-and-coming guy his time?
Well, it's a bit more than that, because Jordi and Johan, both father and son, both admired the work that Bosz had done at Heracles and Vitesse.
Okay.
Earlier, and Jordi had been trying to persuade him to go to Maccabi Tel Aviv for about 2 years, and he didn't really want to go to Israel. It sounds a bit dangerous, and so on. And he wooed him and finally persuaded him to come, came with his girlfriend or something, and had a lovely time and was convinced. And to go, I mean, it was already talked about at that time, you know, this guy's going to be in demand.
Mm.
But if Ajax, there was a clause in his contract saying that if Ajax came in, he was free to go. Anybody else, no, he couldn't go. But if Ajax wanted him. And we don't know exactly if there are conversations that have taken place between the Ajax directors, who are people like Mark Overmars and Edwin van der Sar, who were the sort of beneficiaries in the end of the Cruyff coup. They were on his side, and Cruyff's idea was to have former great players running the club, not suits. So in that respect, it completely was a Cruyff victory. So, and it's said that Cruyff made his peace, even though he'd sort of broken with these guys after all the disputes. He'd made his peace towards the end, and we don't know if he called them or if Jordi called them and said, you know, you really should take this guy; he's terrific.
Right.
But it was kind of in the air.
Yeah. regardless of what happens on Wednesday night, and you know, to use your word, this is all still quite fragile, this return to the more free-flowing Cruyff values. One would have to think, given the excitement in Amsterdam, which you've mentioned to us, and the quality of the football, that ultimately the likes of Overmars and Van der Sar and other players will recognise that surely this is preferable to the more stodgy Van Gaal style.
Well, it was kind of that Frank de Boer was in place and nobody was going to push him out because he was greatly respected and liked personally. And it was only because he chose to leave that the opening came up.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he might have stayed there a lot longer. And it was hardly a disaster. I mean, Ajax in his time won four Dutch league titles in a row.
Mm.
Just that they were getting nowhere in Europe. So I don't know what the future policy. I mean, Bos they'll want to hold on to for as long as they can, if you know, on the current form, and his talent as a manager is remarkable.
Right.
So you know they've got a gem there. How it develops, God only knows.
What kind of character is Bos? Personality?
Don't know.
Right.
I've not spoken to him. I've not met him. He's very in interviews. He's very thoughtful. Highly intelligent, very methodical, it's said, in his preparation. You know, he's observed and learned from Pep Guardiola. You know, his preparation is intense and very, very specific on details and things of that sort. I mean, he's extremely good at motivating his players, but not in a sort of shouty way, just kind of stimulating them and bringing them on. He seems to be terribly good at all that and seems pretty balanced and impressive guy.
Listening to you describe the Ajax style and, you know, maybe a high defensive line and free-flowing and attacking, I just wonder on some level, is Jose Mourinho rubbing his hands and thinking, this is beautiful, this is just what I want?
Well, I think there's hand-rubbing both ways round, because in Amsterdam people are saying, Mourinho is exactly the guy we want to play against because he's going to sit back. He doesn't have really... he hasn't got Ibrahimovic. This might have made a difference.
Mm.
But I see it... Most of your listeners are probably too young to remember. There was a very famous European Cup final in 72. It was kind of the peak of the first great Ajax team where... It was total football against one of Mourinho's later clubs, Inter, playing sort of classic Catenaccio. And it was seen at the time as, you know, a clash of civilizations, philosophies. You know, the attacking, open-hearted kind of style against this cautious, percentages, defensive Catenaccio style.
Mm.
And, you know, you can't compare those. Those were two... very mature teams.
Yeah.
But Ajax on that occasion just blew them away. It was only 2-0, but it could have been a lot more.
Mm.
And it was considered a kind of quite a humiliation. So history repeats itself a little bit.
Mm.
I like to see it in that way anyway.
Yeah. David, absolutely fascinating stuff. Thanks so much for telling us about all this.
My pleasure.
That's the great David Winner there, author of Brilliant Orange and Dennis Bergkamp's book and Rio Ferdinand's autobiography. More recently. So that's what's been going on at Ajax over the last 12 months or so in the guise of Peter Bos in his first season with them. We'll take a short break.
News Talks Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
Thanks to Air with UEFA Champions and Europa Leagues action. Brought to you by Air Sport.
You're welcome back. So we're about done for this evening. We'll podcast all of tonight's best stuff. Jamie Heaslip was in studio back at 7:30 or so. So we'll podcast that chat. There was plenty of GAA. We had Tommy Dunn and Mick Foley, the Sunday Times, on talking about the hurling. We had Brennan Murphy, Carlo's brilliant midfielder, talking about their first win in the championship in 6 years. And we had Billy Joe Patton and Brendan Devaney talking about the weekend's football. And as you've heard this hour, Pat Nevin and the excellent David Winter talking Ajax. So all available in the usual places for podcast. Earlier on, we gave you a chance to win a pair of VIP tickets to our Off the Ball FA Cup 2017 roadshow at the Helix this Thursday, with thanks to Budweiser, official beer of the Emirates FA Cup. Congratulations to Colm O'Farrell You've won the tickets, Colm. You'll be coming along. If you missed out tonight, we'll give you another chance to win another pair of VIP tickets on tomorrow night's show. And remember, you can register for regular tickets for the roadshow at newstalk.com/OTB Helix. Tomorrow night, I'm happy to say, he's back. He's in studio and he's ready to go. Kenny Cunningham was sensational the last time. He spent 3 hours knocking around here talking about whatever. And we said, Kenny, you're in town. Come on over. So Kenny is going to be in studio. Kev will be here as well. We'll be doing our end of season awards. Last year they were called the Killers. They've been called the Kennys in the past. I'm not sure what they're going to be called tomorrow. We'll have to decide that with the lads at 7 o'clock. We haven't settled on all categories, but there'll certainly be Goal of the Year, Manager of the Year, Kenny Shields Rant of the Year and more besides. So we'll be doing our end of season awards and just talking to Kenny Cunningham, which will be good. And on the, we mentioned Ronnie Whelan, as were we thinking maybe he was the guy who had won the most European Cups, Republic of Ireland player with the most European Cups. There's loads of texts in. Did Steve Highway not win 3 European Cups with the pool, says Brian? Alan in Rathote. Steve Highway has 2 European Cup medals, 76 and 77. Although Kevin in Wexford said Steve Highway 77 and 78. We can confirm Steve Highway, 2 European Cups, 77 and 78. So we think no Republic of Irish player has more than 2 that we could think of anyway. Ronnie wasn't in the squad for 81. We mentioned Ronnie because he's coming to the Helix on Thursday. Anyway, none of that ultimately is important whatsoever. We are done for this evening. Tom Dunn is on the way. Kenny Cunningham, myself and Kev back here tomorrow night at 7. Good luck.
Give him a ball and a yard of grass. He'll give you a move for the perfect pass. Give him a ball and a yard of spice.
Off the Ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.